My name is Karen Blomquist, and I'm from Chicago, where I work for the churchwide offices of the ELCA. Although what I'm going to be talking about today isn't directly related to the work that I do there, but it's somehow related to some of the work I was doing previously, including as a parish pastor and trying to do some interpreting of what was going on in terms of some of the cultural realities that many of my parishioners found themselves living with in American society. And so the title of the lecture or discussion or comments or whatever we're going to be doing for the next hour has the probably somewhat strange sounding title, Justified by the American Dream? And that's my way of posing what I think is a central kind of challenge that we as church folk need to think about theologically. To just give you a shorthand version of what we're going to be talking about for the next hour, seems as though there's a strong message within our culture that basically says, you are what you make of yourself. If only you try hard enough, you too can succeed. You too can somehow move up the ladder, et cetera, et cetera. Various kinds of messages that are attached to that. And I think there's a lot of good things that are part of that in terms of a lot of the productivity, there have been a lot of positive things that have come out of that kind of American dream spirit. But I think there's also been some undersides of that. Some things that have also occurred that we aren't always that cognizant, that aware of. And that I think pose particularly some theological challenges for us. And part of what I'm going to be suggesting this afternoon is that I think there's a way in which some of the theological messages of the church, particularly the theme that says we are justified by grace through faith in Jesus Christ and not by what we do, that is in a sense a countercultural message to that central kind of theme within American society. And so that's just to give you a sense of what I'm hoping to lead us into some discussion of this afternoon. Let me begin by indicating something of how this particular theme or emphasis emerged for me. Until about 9 years ago, I served for about 8 years as a pastor of two different congregations on both the West and the East Coast. Both of them were predominantly white working class congregations. And in the process of that, I was also working on a doctorate in theology and trying to find some ways of helping some of the message of the gospel to come alive in relationship to the concrete realities that people were living their lives in. And I was also very involved in a number of different social justice movements and was often very frustrated because I found that my mostly white working class parishioners were often not that open to some of the other justice kinds of emphases that I was interested in and that I incorporated into my preaching. And out of that experience, I began to really to do some analysis of what it was that was going on in the lives of my parishioners, and was helped in that by looking at some of the analyses of what was going on in terms of the changing nature of work in American society. And this was particularly in the early 80s, where in some places around the country there, you know, lots of factories were shutting down and lots of people who had been faithful, loyal workers for all their lives all of a sudden discovered that they too were being laid off and companies were moving out of towns and farmers were experiencing foreclosures, and there were a lot of economic things going on wider forces that were impacting people's lives, and that caused people to say, hey, you know, I really believe that if only I worked hard enough, I would make it. But all of a sudden, that dream was being betrayed. I'm not going to talk that much this afternoon about how that relates to working class people per se, although my own sense is that a far greater proportion of the U.S. working population is working class, probably about two-thirds, far greater than just some narrow stripe that we might think of as blue-collar workers, for example. I do try to explain that a little bit in a book that is over in the bookstore, that a book of mine that was published last year that's called The Dream Betrayed, so some of you might want to pursue some of that a little bit more in depth. But what I want us to talk about a little bit this afternoon is how that kind of message within our culture impacts all of our lives in one way or another. Because I don't think any of us are immune from that, even though at times we might say, oh, well, yeah, we know that that doesn't work for everybody. Nevertheless, I think most of us in this culture, in one way or another, are conditioned with that kind of a message. And it's a kind of message that has therefore often covered over the reality of class in our society. Most commentators who've looked at American society have seen race as a far more significant factor in explaining the inequalities in American society. But in recent years, I think there have been a number of analyses that have looked at the role of class in American society. Now, compared to a lot of European societies, and part of the reason that many of our ancestors came here is that America was seen as being a relatively classless society. And yet, the reality of it is that even though the official slogan is, you are what you make of yourself, and this is a land of opportunity where everybody can better themselves, and certainly that has been a very important message for many immigrant groups, and particularly from a lot of the Northern European immigrant groups that I think many of us have probably come from. Nevertheless, there have been some very real and painful betrayals of that dream. People who realize that, hey, it doesn't always work out that way, and who have been disillusioned, whose expectations have been dashed, and who often become somewhat invisible. In trying to, previously I was teaching at the seminary and tried to help future pastors understand some of the class variables that would likely impact the reality of the people among whom they worked or were going to be pastoring. I said, perhaps one of the most interesting questions that you can ask is, who are the people in your family who weren't talked about when the family history was talked about? Let's just think about that question for a minute. When you talk about, oh, the grandparents and the aunts and the uncles and the great-grandparents, were there some people that became somewhat invisible in that storytelling? There have been a number of studies done that have tried to look at this, and one of them is a book called The Hidden Injuries of Class, but there's a whole number of books that have come out in the last decade or two that have tried to look at this. And increasingly, or what inevitably tended to happen when I would have students do class autobiographies, is that those who somehow had not made it, whatever made it meant, were the ones whose histories, whose stories kind of disappeared. The ones who, for some reason, you know, maybe were part of that immigrant family, but they didn't make it in the way that Uncle Joe did or this one did or whatever. And I think again and again that occurs, that there are people who become invisible, who have not succeeded, who have not climbed the ladder, the cover of this book, interestingly enough, has the ladder of upward mobility, but there's a few rungs missing on this particular ladder. And I think that becomes a very critical issue for us as Christians who are called to pay attention to those who are the vulnerable, to those who, not just to those who are the successes. And that can be sometimes a very painful kind of reality. Those who have made it often find it very difficult to think that highly about those who haven't, because, you know, well, why didn't they have more initiative? Why didn't they have what it takes in order to make it? Now, I think this also becomes a critical set of issues when people are making vocational choices as to what they're going to do or do not, or do with their lives, and having to deal with the constant questions, well, what are you going to do when you grow up, or what are you going to do when you get out of college? People who go through all kinds of midlife crises, and certainly the whole host of people for whom daily life is a constant struggle for economic survival. And that sense of how can I make it, how can I succeed, how can I get ahead, or at least survive, affects not only, you know, what one does, but it also very deeply impacts one's sense of identity and one's sense of worth. And I think, therefore, in a very real way, that message affects a lot of us and becomes that kind of gnawing feeling of, I've got to justify myself. At least I've got to make something of myself. And I think that is related to a number of different factors in our society. And I'm going to be discussing some of them in a minute. But it is connected with that kind of promise of freedom and equality and happiness for all, which is a part of the good life and the American dream that undergirds that. And that yearning for the good life is therefore a central aspiration for many of us, for most of us, and it at times has almost a religious kind of aura to it. There certainly are some religious groups that make that a very central kind of script, a kind of, you know, well, if you only believe in Jesus Christ, you too can succeed and be blessed and have all of these good things. Some of the TV evangelists certainly play on that rather strongly. Growth and upward mobility become the standards by which things get measured, by which we measure ourselves. Hunger for more ends up being promoted as a moral imperative. Bigger or more is better, the highest possible profit. And those messages become the kind of prevailing discourse, the kind of prevailing language, the prevailing language of power, as some have put it. And at times can become some unquestioned absolutes for which persons and communities are often sacrificed. I'm thinking now of the plants that close because a company can't make the highest possible profit in that particular community. Let me just pause for a minute and see if what I'm saying resonates with your experience, or if for some of you, you see this playing itself out in some different ways. In other words, does this resonate, or do you feel a need to challenge some of what I've said thus far?
I think it resonates. My experience is I worked for a corporation, and the things you're talking about in the early 80s, I think, have only intensified in terms of corporations trying to be more cost-conscious and competitive with foreign competition. And so they're reducing work staffs, and the remainder of the people they put more work on and continually ask for more. They reward them well for that. Mm-hmm. But there's they sort of take more and more of your life, and there's no middle ground with respect to that. You either continue to move forward and go along with that lifestyle, or you drop out of it completely, and then that's too risky for most people to even think about doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your worth is proved by how much you have. So if you have nothing, then you aren't worth anything either. You must show that you have worth and you've done this and you can buy those and those things. And it's even more important if you haven't a very good education, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Then you must prove even more, have even a bigger car or whatever. So the society is a consumer society. But I was also thinking about what you said about religion. It's of course most clear in the Calvinist tradition, where it was a proof of God's, that you were among the saved, that you you made it.
You were blessed by God.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, in Lutheranism, it has been work, but it's very important that you... I can see that in the Swedish society, for instance. We don't have the American dream, but I recognize what you are talking about anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's because, for instance, if you lose your work, you don't have any value. Or you have much less value, because what are you doing? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you survive there, I mean, you survive, but still, it's terrible for people to lose work. And midlife crisis, and you look back at your life and say, oh, I didn't make it. I what have I done? I haven't made it. Career or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So this value in what's, it's not your inner person or your it's what you have done, not what you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other responses or other connecting or not connecting with this. Let me go on and share with you one way that I've sometimes tried to talk about how this functions and why it's so difficult to get a hold of this. Because I think most of us take this message for granted. And for the most part, there is evidence that the message has worked for enough of us, probably for enough of us in this room, and for enough of our family members, or quite frankly, we probably wouldn't be able to afford the time and money to come to a place like Holden. So it may be that I'm asking us to think about the people who aren't here, too. But I think what there are three central messages that I think function in an interrelated way to help keep this whole thing kind of mystified, so that we don't always see what's going on and we don't always see the underside of this. Certainly one of the messages, and this is nothing new, there's lots of commentators that talk about the pervasive individualism in our society, but the very way in which that message of the American dream is cast, you know, how can I make it, or how can I and my family make it, because I think certainly within certain ethnic racial groups in this society, it's not so individualized, but it is at least, you know, the family. I'm thinking now particularly some African American and Hispanic cultures where there is more of a communal sense. But for many of us, there is that acute sense of individualism, and the onus is on the individual to make a difference, individual effort, know-how, or at times just plain luck will determine whether one acquires the good life. And so in this individualism, we're set in a competitive rather than a cooperative relationship with others. And I think that can occur even in the church. It's not just in those corporations, but I think this, unfortunately, this message can at times pervade the church also. And therefore, in this message of individualism, we're not likely to let on if we are failing. Now, when it results in problems like alcoholism or drug abuse or marriages that break up or a host of other problems, then all of a sudden, after the fact, we wake up and realize the burden that that person may in fact have been carrying. But for the most part, we don't let on that we're failing. I've heard accounts, for example, of churches, where people lost their job and they disappeared from church because the first place they didn't want anybody to know about that was in church, which I think is a rather sad commentary, because if there's one place that could hopefully provide some countercultural ground to this message, it's the church. But that has not always been the case.
Well, another similar thing is you often don't want to let on that you don't want to move up. You're satisfied where you are.
Yeah.
It's risky to even say that.
Yeah, of course you want a promotion. Of course you want it.
Right.
Yeah. Somehow you're abnormal if you don't want that advancement. That you might want to say, hey, there's other things in life that are as important as that. Well, I think one of the cycles that operates in is individualism, with all the various messages connected with that. And the kind of flip side of individualism that can overtake people at times is a feeling of victimization. So all of a sudden, when one loses one's job, or when somehow the bottom feels like it's falling out, there's a sense of, look what was done to me. And a kind of fatalism, a kind of passivity at times of, here I've said there's an active idealism, I can make it, I can, if only I try, and then all of a sudden the flipping around, and it becomes an acute feeling of victimization at times. And rather than that becoming an opportunity to say, okay, how can we talk together and look at what's going on, and perhaps look at some of the political and economic factors that are related to that, more often than not, victimization results in a kind of privatization. This is where, for example, many therapists become aware of how all of the wider structural forces that have impacted people in our society come home to bear here, and if one is disillusioned with all the other stuff out there, at least home and family is where one turns to continue to receive that affirmation and that sense of worth and dignity. And I think at times that becomes too heavy a burden for many families to bear up under. So there's to hell with the rest of the world, at least I'm going to try to carve out a niche for home and family, and therefore a kind of recommitment to the individualism, and I can make it if only I try hard enough. My reason for sketching that out there is I think this is an example, and we could think of other examples of this too, of some of the reigning messages in our society that we often accept as given without really critiquing them and without raising some questions about some of the wider structural forces that are impacting our lives, and that I think need to be addressed by the church. Too often the church has addressed only the individuals who are impacted without looking in a somewhat more proactive way at some of those wider forces that are affecting people and communities. I think, for example, if we take the understanding of sin has been often interpreted in a very individualistic kind of way. What has the individual done wrong? And even though we might say, it's not what that worker's done wrong that's caused them to lose their job, nevertheless, I think that individualism very much impacts how we understand certain things within within our theology. Even though for people like St. Paul and for Luther, there was very much an understanding of sin as a power of domination. Luther, for example, dealt with that when he talked about what was kind of the reigning institutional reality of his day, which was the institution of the papacy. And I don't want, not that I want this to sound like an anti-Catholic kind of polemic, but I think he had an early awareness of how these institutional realities can envelop people's lives so that we feel dominated by them. We feel, you know, that there's no way out. You know, they become an all-encompassing kind of system. And it's there where I think there are some important kinds of messages that also come from out of the heart of our faith that can provide some resources for really challenging and critiquing what's going on. One of the things that I appreciate about the Christian faith understood particularly through some Lutheran sensitivities is that I think there is the potential for really critiquing what is going on, not just to accept the given. But whenever anything like this becomes an unquestioned absolute in people's lives, and therefore functions kind of like an idol, something that we say, well, that's the way it is, and you don't question it, there's a kind of critical tension that arises from out of our faith that enables us
is
to question
true?
Some of that.
I mean,
does it function? Does it really happen?
The workers' movement criticized the church very much because they said people were told to obey and to not to criticize, only to do what they were told, and it exists even in Lutheranism.
Mm-hmm.
You should obey the, I don't know the English.
Obey the authorities.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 I think no. I think that's been a very strong emphasis of, you know, obey the people in authority and power.
And you shouldn't really think that they could do anything wrong if it's because of other uncontrollable circumstances that it has happened. But it couldn't be the government's fault or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And well, it has changed, but there was some truth to it. But
I think that's
Christians were afraid of being dealing with politics too much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think what you're saying is certainly been the pervasive tendency of, you know, obey the, you know, these are the powers that be, obey them. But I think there also is a built-in tension to.
I don't know. Maybe you people came here to be because they didn't obey.
I think the historical record is that pervasive message has tended to prevail. What I'm trying to get at are some aspects of that I think can begin to challenge that and to raise some questions about that. But I appreciate your bringing that out because, quite frankly, I think our own Lutheran tradition has more often tended to reinforce that rather than to challenge that. So let me just raise some questions. Through events like the resurrection, the domination or the fear or the sin as a kind of reigning power over us, is not only challenged or transformed, but overcome. God inaugurates a new reality through Christ's life, death, and resurrection. And that's much of what Paul in his epistles ends up talking about. God in Christ rejects self-enclosed systems of domination and the subservience that they so often demand. But there is a sense in which the death and resurrection and the early church that came out of that, even though it usually wasn't used in a way that transformed structures, certainly in terms of more recent liberation and political theologies, there that kind of possibility is being opened up, and people rereading some of that early material. I think it's important that we recognize that the God who is revealed on the cross is the opposite of that kind of God, the kind of pseudo-God that is a part of the kind of American dream that says, well, if only you work hard enough and you're justified by your work and by all your efforts. But instead, there is the possibility of really challenging some of the kind of message that I think the kind of cultural message that envelops so many of us tends to perpetuate. The resurrection helps to break through the domination and the fear that it generates. It proclaims that amid the helplessness and death and the sense of powerlessness that we face, you know, that's part of what this all generates, is a sense of powerlessness. Victimization is, I think, a synonym for what we might talk about as a sense of powerlessness, and people kind of striking out, not quite knowing, you know, what to do other than feeling that I'm somehow not in charge in the way that I've been told I'm in charge of my life. And therefore, I think there is a sense in which being baptized into Christ and being baptized into Christ's death and resurrection means that we as Christians have a new vision of reality. We live in the world with all of its brokenness and with all of its broken promises, including its broken promises of the American dream. But at the same time, we are not totally of the world. There is a kind of built-in tension there. The world and its ways and its assumptions, the world's ways of ordering relationships are put into perspective and are, you know, are continually challenged whenever they become absolutes. Faith, therefore, is not separate from our experience in the world, but it provides the perspective that enables us to be able to stand aside and to critique what's going on and to say, hey, how do we get ensnared in some of that? And how does our faith enable us to stand and give us some perspective on all of that? One of the phrases that Luther used was what it means to stand coram Deo, in other words, to stand in the presence of or in the face of God, and that enables us to see all of reality as being in the presence of God. When we have that kind of perspective, it means that the various kinds of messages in society that tend to overtake us and become absolutes are challenged. Through that sense of being in Christ, we have a perspective on what is real, namely that we are justified, not by what we do, but we are justified by grace through faith. We are redeemed. We are becoming new creations. And yet we still live with the reign of sin. It's not that we just say, oh, well, now that's all removed. We don't have to worry about that. But it involves a communal struggle, and there's a place in Luther's works where he talks about it being a communal struggle against sin, not just the individual, because, you know, individualism was not the problem for him in his day as it is for us today. Instead of salvation sought in what we make of ourselves over and against others, and that's really what I'm saying is a very central message in our culture. You know, you're saved by what you make of yourself. Instead of that, salvation emerges as we identify with those who have clearly not made it. I think the over against others kind of tendency in our society so that we at least want to be able to assure ourselves that we're better than so-and-so, better than a group that's perhaps just below us, who clearly haven't made it. That need is somehow addressed, I think, through some of the central symbols, through some of the central understandings of our faith. No longer do we need the needy for our self-justification. Let me unpack that a bit. I think there can be a tendency in which we say, well, at least I'm better than so-and-so, so therefore I will feel good about helping them. And I think there's a part of that that's good, but it can also be a way in which we help to not stand with others, but stand over and against others. And when that happens, I think we need to raise some questions about it. But it is our acceptance of God's gracious gift, of God's justification, of God's forgiveness, of God's new life that engages us in the task of struggling against those injustices that not only afflict other people, but also afflict ourselves, and to do so in new relationships of community with one another. And I think that's what's happening in lots of places around this country, where people catch a sense of that and begin to struggle in some new ways with one another. Just to give you a very small example, this was from about 10 years ago. One of my parishioners who had a really tough life working on the railroads in New York City and had a very hard life. There was a lot of alcoholism and abuse of one kind or another in his family, and had really been very open about sharing that and about sharing the kind of structural realities that he didn't use structural realities, but the wider forces that were affecting his life. And one night we were doing some Lenten series on what was happening with some peasants in El Salvador, and all of a sudden Harold spoke up and he said, "You know, I know what it's like to have a foot on your neck when you really don't know which way to turn." And, you know, it began this whole litany of his making some very real connections between some of the rather clear domination and oppression that he had experienced and what, in fact, the peasants in El Salvador that he was reading about were experiencing. That was very small, but I think significant kind of moment, because it wasn't a matter of saying, well, how can I feel sorry for those people? But it was a movement to begin to stand with. And I came back to visit a year later, and this was also helped by the fact that my successor was very involved in Latin American solidarity work. But the citywide memorial service, the New York citywide memorial service for Archbishop Romero was occurring in that particular congregation. And some of the members who, you know, constantly saw the Hispanics and African Americans who were moving into the community as kind of a threat, they were the ones who were saying, "Hey, look at our new members." And so there was a connection that occurred, not just a standing over and against and saying, well, at least we're better than those folks. I mean, this was a congregation that was so determined to demonstrate that they belonged to a different district, one that was more white than the other one. But all of a sudden, there was a beginning to name some of their pain and some of what they had experienced in their work life and in the wider society that provided some possibility for them to see some connections about how resources within their faith helped to challenge some of that and enable them to stand with and not simply over and against. And I think there's, you know, I don't think those are at all isolated examples, because I think there's more and more groups within our society, and it may be that particularly a place like Holden Village tends to attract people who are disillusioned by those predominant messages connected with the American dream. But I think that's a crucial kind of challenge of trying to be clear and trying to be aware of those very subtle ways in which we all get hooked into it. You know, I get as hooked into it as anyone in terms of my workaholism, and I can say, oh, well, yeah, I believe all this good Christian stuff, but when push comes to shove, you know, there's pecking orders that operate in the church as well as in the wider society, and I think we can get caught into that. And the question is, how can the church be a community where we challenge some of that and where we don't cause those who haven't made it to feel that somehow they are a source of, you know, they should be ashamed or a source of embarrassment. But how can we really become that community of faith that takes seriously the way in which those promises in the wider society are often disappointed, and in ways that can become very devastating to lots of people. Let me stop talking and hear from some of you about some experiences, maybe some ways in which you see this sort of thing being countered in terms of yourself or people that you're in community with, or ways in which you see your church trying to counter some of those messages.
I have a question. I shouldn't talk too much, but I wonder, do you think this American dream and this individualistic approach, which is very emphasized here, do you think that's the reason why political solutions seem to be more far away for certain things? People seem to not to think very often in political things could be solved politically. But they, for instance, when I came here, I was very astonished at child care, maternity leave, a lot of things didn't, they existed, but on a very, very low scale, and people didn't seem to struggle. I was so astonished that this country, where people are so aware of all, of everything, and they didn't seem to want bigger things to happen, the political parties aren't the same. They aren't working in the same way as in Europe, mm-hmm. for instance. And I was very I admire the way Americans often volunteer. They do a lot of things without being paid, but then certain things that could have been solved long ago, they aren't, because you should do it yourself. I'm so astonished about that, and I wonder why. Because the level of education, everything is very high. But then...
Well, I think the individualism is very key in that, and how strong that has come through. And certainly there have been analyses of, you know, looking at public policy in Europe compared to here. I mean, obviously your country and ours are especially stark. There's stark differences there.
Well, they have a lot in general, but this is a very big difference here, mm-hmm.
And certainly around the child care issue, if you're going to have kids, you've got to somehow provide. This is the basic message.
And how should people put up with that? Leaving, I mean, going to work after a few weeks. I'm so astonished. Or you stay at home, even if you are a doctor or whatever. Or you could make some private solution, maybe, if you have resources enough. But if you don't, And still people are very active in churches. There is all this, what you were talking about. Christianity seems to have a bigger impact here. But why doesn't it impact more, have a bigger impact on politics then? Or I'm silly, of course. I'm coming from outside. I'm not.
Your questions are very. I would like for us to think, and for some of the rest of us to get into this in responding to her question, because I think it is a very central one.
The one thing I was thinking when she was talking about some of this stuff is the way we approach our tax system. Is that in this country we feel that when we pay our taxes we're wasting our money, where in other European countries when they pay their taxes they demand services for their tax dollars. Our structure is not quite set up that way. The government decides where our money goes and we don't really push one way or the other as to where those dollars are going to go, and it has a lot to do with that individual approach that we take care of ourselves, the government takes care of its business, and we all take care of, you know, we all have our little responsibilities. But we don't look at it as a whole structure of where we are moving forward. We don't have that linking together and moving together as a nation. We move together individually as a nation, within that nation, I guess. Mm-hmm. So that's, it has a lot to do, well, from my perspective, the way we approach taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, other countries approach taxes from a basis that I demand services for my dollars. And if I have a representative, I'm going to want these services to be, you know, stayed on the floor of the Congress or wherever they meet. And we don't have that kind of feeling here. We elect our officials and they go do whatever they want to half the time. And we think they're all crooked anyway. So we don't trust them, you know. So why should we trust them with more of our dollars for health care or all these other programs that she was talking about? We would be overtaxed, right? So forget that. I'm not going to have that happen to me, forget it.
Of course, we are overtaxed in Sweden anyway, but...
But your percentage of benefits is much higher than our percentage of benefits.
Yes.
Our money goes to protect the rich in this country, not to protect us. I mean, we reap that in a sense, because it's a trickle-down sort of thing. We have a safe nation, but it benefits the rich much more because they have much more wealth to protect than what we have.
So you mean it's because people don't trust the politicians, and that's
exactly. Exactly. We think it's, you know, more money being wasted, which
but they are voted for by the voters. I mean,
but the percentage of people voting are so small, it's
keeps shrinking. Yeah.
Our country is not a political country. We're democratic, but we don't really get involved in that. We're just kind of bored.
Keep voting the same bums in every time.
Very much so. It would be nice to become more political.
I think that as far as the issues with childcare, I think, and those types of issues across the board, no matter what your economic level is, you still want that individualism. You want that choice to pick where you're going to put your child and where you're going to go to the doctor. I'm talking anywhere above where you're on public assistance and are going on Medicaid.
Yes, but then if you don't have any health care at all, how could you put up with that? I mean, it's so terrible.
Well, I don't understand how that, but I'm saying anywhere you're above that level, you still want that choice to go where you want to go.
Yes.
And I lived down in the South for a number of years, and their family structure is much different down there.
Where?
I was down in the southern
part of
the yes, States. And their family structure is different, and they're much more of an extended family than I think the northern states are. But I do think that sense of choice for everybody, I think, really gets in our way.
Mm-hmm. If it works, it's wonderful.
But
if it does work, it's the...
I hate to keep interjecting. The one thing that I've thought a lot about is the way that the issue of healthcare is being addressed in this country too. And there are a lot of dollars being thrown out into the market in a sense to scare people to think that some kind of national policy would limit your choice. And that's done by people who control the medical field today. I mean, they're reaping a lot of money because we're not uniting together and looking at this as a communal thing. And they're able to gouge us as much as they would like, and they can say, I'm an expert, and it's in their benefit to keep us confused and not trusting. They're going to take my choice away? I want my choice. But other countries have set things up differently where you still do have choices. The American system somehow, we don't look to other nations for examples. We always think that we have to have the best example here at home. And in a lot of ways, we could learn a lot from some smaller European countries about how to do things sometimes.
Well, and I think sometimes the rhetoric gets in the way of the reality. There was some study came out last month. I just heard it on NPR. I didn't see it in the paper, but ranking numbers of freedoms in various countries, and the U.S. comes out number 11. I mean, we'd like to think we have more freedoms and, you know, more freedoms of choice, freedom of choice kinds of issues, etc., or, you know, basic rights, etc. And we are not
oh,
close
no.
to the top.
We're
number 11 isn't too far down, but at
who
least...
Who are above us?
I don't know. I didn't see the whole. No. All I know is where the U.S. ranked on that particular scale.
Where, for example, where is Japan?
I didn't see the. I just heard the report of it
Japan
and heard it referred
to
a number of times.
But there are other smaller European
nations. I would think they're a lot below us.
Or far above
yeah.
us.
Other reactions to this, or reflections in terms of your own experience, or of those you know, and
I would like to ask you a question, and I'm not sure I can phrase this properly, but in this cycle, do you see this as a cycle that pertains to the majority in our country, or would some of the minorities have this played out in a different way, or would this?
This was developed particularly thinking of the situation that was facing a lot of white working class folks almost a decade ago. But the more I've thought about it and talked about it, I realize I think it impacts most of us. It's not just limited to one segment of the population. But you know, it switches from here, from individualism to victimization at those points when there somehow is a betrayal of that dream. And then how do we explain it? Because, you know, we want to at least preserve our feeling that we're okay in the midst of this. You know, we've done what we can, we've been righteous, we've been, you know, good workers, etc. And then all of a sudden, it's wider forces overtake us. And so I think that can happen in many different ways. It's not just people losing their jobs, but it might be what happens to this neighborhood that we've put so much energy into building up, and you know, number of ways that could play itself out. But I think it this conversation between, you know, the lack of the kind of public policies that there might be in many places of Europe, I think that's explained right here in this part. It's, well, okay, it's my home and family, and you know, maybe I can get Uncle so-and-so to help me out if I have some extended family that can help out. But it's not that at this point it's, well, now what can the government do? I mean, certainly for some people they might begin to think in that direction, but the predominant message is no, the government is a leech.
You know? Exactly.
Therefore, you know, interesting, the point you were raising earlier, you know, about that kind of, you know, from out of our Lutheran tradition, that sense of, you know, the appropriate role of governing authorities. I think there's also some good stuff in there about, you know, government taking...